Eku Iluna, please rise. Auhea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuleana imua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki ike hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naui mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Felina, everyone. Makamoku puni o Oahu I ka moku o kona e ia no ka koma a lio lani hale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at a li'i o lani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000255. State of Hawaii, Respondent Plaintiff Appellee versus Henry K. Tolentino, Petitioner Defendant Appellant. Arguing for Petitioner Henry K. Tolentino, Kai Lawrence. Arguing for Respondent, State of Hawaii, Brian Vincent. Argument on the merits.
Aloha kakahiak. Good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, and I'd like to welcome our substitute justices in this case, Judge Jordan Kimura and Judge Rebecca Copeland. Thank you for joining us today. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Lawrence, you will have 25 minutes and 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Vincent, you will have 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning. Mr. Lawrence, please proceed.
Aloha mai kakou. O kai ko'u inoa. Noho ao I makiki Honolulu. My name is Kai Lawrence, and I am court-appointed appellate counsel for Henry K. Tolentino, who is present in court today. Mr. Tolentino commonly goes by his middle name, which is Keone, and so I'll refer to him by that moniker today. This case, Honorable Justices, Keone's case, a case that has already affected his life for several years and that could have ramifications for several years more on his life to come. This case is ultimately a case about a failure of process. It is about the erroneous admission of an inculpatory statement made by the defendant, which was never subject to a true voluntariness determination by the trial court. Now, this is problematic because our case law notes that this right, the right against self-incrimination, is, as our courts have noted in Kelekolio, it is axiomatic to our criminal jurisprudence. Justice Pollack in State versus Baker, 147 Hawaii 413, he said that this is, quote, one of our most critical procedural safeguards, the having a voluntariness hearing before a statement is allowed in at trial. Our statutes require this as well, HRS 621-26, and it requires a true voluntariness hearing. Jackson versus Deno, which is a United States Supreme Court case, says that when the inculpatory statement is sought to be entered into court, the defendant, quote, is entitled to a fair hearing in which both the underlying factual issues and the voluntariness of the confession are actually and reliably determined. That never happened in this case. And speaking of law, I'll note one other point. That is from State versus Bowe, B-O-W-E, 81 P. 2nd, 538, that the burden is on the prosecution to show that the statement was voluntarily given. It is not and not the product of coercion. It is never the defendant's job to raise this. It is the state's job.
Mr. Lawrence,
yes.
In your application for cert, you do point to the Jackson versus Deno case and rely on it quite heavily. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that the facts there were clearly in dispute. And this is where a defendant had been hospitalized and was interviewed after being hospitalized and also after being medicated. Are the facts really in dispute here? I mean, didn't the trial court judge ask about whether there were questions and whether there was coercion?
You are correct. But the law requires, this is from Kelly Colio again, it requires a review of the totality of the circumstances, and that there was no totality here. The only time this was raised significantly was at the motion in limine hearing, and that was only via argument. You're correct that the judge did focus on whether a question was asked, so focusing on coercion. But there are so many other factors at issue that there was never an opportunity to present them to the court, such as the fact that the defendant had been just tackled. He had been pinned by police. He had been beaten several times in the face by the officer. The beating so hard that it actually broke the police officer's hand in the process. And then he was handcuffed. And so those facts are not in dispute. But the effect on the defendant, that was never presented to the court. And whether or not he was in a state to be able to make a voluntary statement.
I guess I just wonder if there's a need for some kind of like offer of proof to require that actual hearing where a defendant could testify without fear that that testimony would be used at the trial, right? That's clear in our case law that they should be able to testify at a voluntariness hearing without the threat of it being used at trial. But does there need to be an offer of proof or some kind of, or something more than what's in this record where the court has asked about the circumstances?
I think speaking to our record, I think there was enough of an offer of proof based on those factors, those facts, the fact that the defendant had just been tackled and beaten and was handcuffed at the time that he made the statement. I think that those raised the issue sufficient enough for the court to have triggered the requirement of a full voluntariness hearing. And interestingly, in Jackson, Jackson's comparable because there, again, it wasn't a situation of police coercion. It was what were the other factors affecting the defendant that could have affected voluntariness. The fact that there, the defendant had just had an injury, he'd been shot, he was on medication at the hospital, he'd been refused water. All of those factors could have affected voluntariness, thus triggering the right. Similar situation in our case.
Thank you.
Mr. Lawrence, wasn't the facts in the Jackson case that there was actually custodial interrogation? So is your argument that you can have an issue of coercion outside the context of custodial interrogation?
Yes. And regarding coercion, I think that coercion is less of the issue in our case. And I bring it up related to Jackson. I'm glad you brought it up as well, because coercion there was less the issue. Because yes, it was a custodial interrogation case, but they weren't so focused on what were the actions of the police, what were the questions of the police. Same here. In Jackson, what triggered the right was the other factors, the situation that the defendant was making the statement within, not necessarily specifically coercion. Same in our case.
How does the trial court distinguish between what's inculpatory and what's an innocuous statement?
That is a great question. So first of all, it requires a totality of the circumstances review. In Kelly Colio, the court there noted that this requirement doesn't just apply to confessions, but it also applies to inculpatory statements. And to reach that conclusion, they quoted Black's Law Dictionary, and I'll quote here. It says, while a confession admits commission of a crime, an inculpatory statement admits a fact, circumstance, or involvement which tends to establish guilt or from which guilt may be inferred. In our case, the statement from the defendant was, I'm sorry. That statement admits a circumstance or involvement which tends to establish guilt or from which guilt can be inferred. And turning to the case, to more of the facts of the case, the fact that the prosecution specifically relied on that statement to show a consciousness of guilt raises it to the level of needing a voluntariness hearing. And what I'm referring to is the fact that the prosecution in their closing argument, not once but twice, raised it to the jury saying that he said he's sorry, this means he knew he was guilty.
You mentioned the prosecution intended use. When you look at the totality of the circumstances, would you think that, I guess, the content and the language of the statement, the context of the statement, the prosecution's intended use of the statement, and really the probative tendency, are those all factors that you would look at as far as whether a statement is inculpatory and should merit a voluntariness hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that all of those are relevant factors that would merit a voluntariness hearing.
Now, when there is an inculpatory statement, isn't that then really the offer of proof? I mean, you don't really need an offer of proof by either party to suggest it. Isn't the court required to have a voluntariness hearing when there is an inculpatory statement?
100%. I agree with that, definitely. And I think Jackson versus Deno supports that as well, because quoting from that case, quoting here, they said, although Jackson's counsel did not specifically object to the admission of the confession initially, the trial court indicated its awareness that Jackson's counsel was questioning the circumstances under which Jackson was interrogated. So again, I think apart from what's raised, what the offer of proof is, if there's enough there for the court on its own to see that this could be an inculpatory statement, that triggers the right.
By the way, why is that United States Supreme Court even, why do we even care about that court? Why couldn't we just decide under our state court grounds?
I 100% agree with that, because as this court is aware, our state constitution can and often does offer greater protections to individuals than our United States Constitution does. And I'll cite, just as an example, Ke Kanawai Mamalaho, the law of the splintered paddle. It's codified in our constitution, and it is there to specifically protect those that are vulnerable within our system. That includes defendants. And so I think our Hawaii Constitution does give greater protections than even the United States Constitution. So even under Jackson versus Deno, I think that the law is clear. But in Hawaii, it's even more clear that the protections need to be followed. And just to continue on with that, the inculpatory nature of the statement, there are a few other salient facts that I think show that this needed a voluntariness hearing. The first is the fact that the jury actually rejected the state's initial theory of the case. He was initially charged with an intentional and knowing assault on a police officer. The jury rejected that, acquitted him of that, and he was instead convicted of the lesser offense, which is a reckless assault on a police officer. I think that that's important because the issue turned on credibility, and it shows that the jury did not believe the police officers on key points. And that makes an inculpatory apologetic statement from the defendant even more powerful to the jury. So it's hard to say what effect that actually had on the jury, especially given that it clearly was a close call for the jury. It takes on even more prominence in that situation. And again, speaking to the inculpatory nature of the statement, here we have an apology that could be seen as ambiguous. We have police violence, we have custody, and we have physical injury to the defendant. All of those things present a heightened due process concern that should have triggered the right to a voluntariness hearing.
In terms of the jury choosing the included offense as opposed to the charged offense, does that impact whether admission of the statement that we're concerned with, does that matter for purposes of whether it was harmless or not?
I think it does for the very same argument that I just made. It was very much clearly a close call. And so the fact that the jury still convicted on the lesser included, I think it definitely speaks to whether or not this was harmless, because that could have been the reason they still convicted.
The element there is reckless conduct, right?
Correct.
And so I guess your position is that the statement, "I'm sorry," can apply both to intentional knowing conduct and under the charged offense as well as reckless conduct under the
definitely
included
I think
offense.
Someone can be sorry for any conduct, whether that be reckless, intentional, knowing. And I think that that's what the jury found in this case.
Or negligent, for that matter.
No, or negligent.
You were talking about in your briefing about intoxication as being a factor, but you know, isn't intoxicated statement always voluntary? I mean, you can't just say, hey, no, it's not voluntary because I was super drunk. I mean, shouldn't we get intoxication out of the mix in this case?
You know,
you can't use that as an excuse, can you?
I have chosen not to pursue that in the argument today because I agree. I think it's a less strong argument. I think there may be some merit to it, but I think the other facts in this case are much stronger. The fact of being tackled, being under arrest, and having just been punched in the face several times. And one thing that's crucial about this too, Your Honors, is that the court did discuss this issue at the motions in limine hearing, No evidence was presented, just argument. But one thing that's crucial there is that the court was relying on an incorrect statement of fact from the prosecution at that hearing when it made its preliminary determination of voluntariness. The court asked, was he in custody at the time that the statement was made? And the judge said, the prosecutor said, the officer was effectuating the arrest. That's implying that no, he wasn't in custody. He was in the process of being arrested. But later at trial, the facts clearly showed that he had been tackled, pinned, beaten, and then cuffed before he made the statement. And I think that that's crucial because if you look at the trial transcript and the judge discussing the issue later at trial, and by the way, that discussion is very short. It's something like 10 lines out of thousands of lines of transcript. The judge spent about less than a minute on this issue at trial. But the judge specifically said, in that moment, the judge said, the judge said, okay, I believe I made that finding during motions in limine, and I'll make it again. And then the judge said, I think that the statement or the utterance that was made by the defendant to the officer was an excited utterance. There was no coercion. There was no question asked by the officer when the defendant made the unsolicited statement. So the judge referenced her prior ruling. And I think that the problem there is that the judge let the prior ruling do the legwork at the trial as far as making the determination.
Well, I mean, at the preliminary pretrial stage, she clearly said, I'm going to see what the evidence shows, right, at
Correct.
Trial. If it shows that there was questioning or coercion, then I'm not going to let it in. She clearly said that, too, at the pretrial stage. During the trial, when the issue came up again, and again, I agree with you, it was a very brief discussion, there was no objection whatsoever by the defense, right? So I know your position is still nonetheless, based on the record at that point, the court should have held a voluntariness hearing. Clearly, well, I guess I should get your position on this. I mean, certainly at the trial stage, the court could call for a recess, have that voluntariness hearing outside the presence of the jury, and that would suffice in your view, right?
I do think that would suffice, yes.
Let me ask you this, though. How would that suffice if it's suppressed and the prosecution doesn't have an opportunity to take an interlocutory appeal? Jeopardy is attached.
I haven't thought of that issue, and I think that that does raise a good issue. I think that wasn't the case in our set of facts, but I could see that set of facts happening and that being an issue with a later determination.
Isn't that why our case law is pretty clear that these matters happen before trial and a voluntariness here happens before trial? Chang's all over that.
Yes, definitely. Several cases refer to it. The fact that it needs to be done prior to. In this case, the ICA ruled that having it during the case was enough, but I agree. I think that there is definitely an argument to be made that due process requires a pre-trial hearing, not just a during trial hearing.
So that wasn't requested either. There was no objection in that regard either. The court clearly pre-trial said, I'm going to see what the evidence is during trial. Right.
That's correct. But as I mentioned, the burden is on the prosecution to raise this issue. They're the ones who need to request the voluntariness hearing. Never did in this case. Also, at the motion in limine hearing, the objection was raised by trial counsel at that hearing, not once, not twice, but three times, very clearly. If I can quote the first objection, he says, I mean, it could be deemed a confession, so we'd like to get a voluntariness, unquote, hearing. Later, he says, it's just the problem is, like in terms of voluntariness, I mean, obviously defendant would have a right to respond and to testify if we had an actual voluntariness hearing. Here, we're not even going to have that. And then later in the discussion, as the court was issuing its ruling, trial counsel said, and I understand that part of it, it's just the voluntariness part. But you know, in terms of it being, it could be seen as a confession, as an admission. So that's, and the issue is like, you know, this could have been decided with a voluntariness hearing. And at that point, the judge cut him off and said, you've made your record. And so I think that the issue was presented well enough by trial counsel at that hearing to require a pretrial voluntariness determination.
Mr. Lawrence, can I just take you a step back again? Because you indicated that the state never requested the voluntariness hearing initially, and it was their burden to do so. Other than State versus Hopkins, do you have any cases where it would stand for the proposition that that would need to occur outside the context of custodial interrogation? Because I believe the judge mentioned on several occasions, the trial judge, that there was no question posed.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have any specific cases. And I think if I understand your question, you're saying, is the burden still on the state, even where it's not a custodial interrogation?
No, I think my question is going back even a step further, which is when we're addressing this issue of voluntariness and whether or not it needs to be addressed in a case itself, doesn't it have to occur within the context, the statement, the inculpatory statement or confession, in the context of a custodial interrogation?
No, I don't have any case law specifically related to that. Well, actually, I do have two cases that I can cite to. I mentioned State v. Hopkins. I think you said other than State v. Hopkins.
Other than State versus yes. Hopkins.
In State versus Hewitt, this is 149 Hawaii 71. There, that was an OVUII case or a drunk driving case. And there, the defendant had been driving while drunk and ended up crashing her car. And that resulted in injuries to the defendant. She ended up leaving the car where it was and walked over to the hospital to get help. Police were able to identify that that was her car, and they questioned her about it at the hospital. There wasn't a custody interrogation, it was just a regular police contact. And there, the statement she said she informed the officer that she had been driving the vehicle and that she had left it there parked in the bushes. And the reviewing court said, yes, that is inculpatory, even though it wasn't the product of coercion and even though it was not a specific confession to OVUII. And so I think that that case does stand for that proposition that custodial interrogation, while one factor, it's just one part of the totality of circumstances.
It's not dispositive, is it? I mean, can't confessions be made to people who are not police officers? I mean, look at the Bow case where you had the coach telling the player to go down to the police station. That was deemed involuntary. So is it not true that custodial interrogation just doesn't matter? It's not dispositive. It is a factor, as you mentioned.
Correct.
Right.
I think the Bow case is spot on. Yes.
And let me ask you this. So, you know, Rule 16, if there's any statement by a defendant who's going to be used by the prosecution, that's got to be, given to the defense. Now, I'm wondering, and you've touched upon this a little bit, is who's incumbent upon it? I mean, you know, you filed a motion in limine, or the defense filed a motion in limine this case. There could have been a motion to suppress. Prosecution could have come in with a motion for voluntariness. I'm hearing you sort of say that the court's the gatekeeper. I mean, is this sort of a shared responsibility? Who's ultimately responsible?
I think ultimately the court is responsible when it's presented with a set of facts which could trigger the right to a voluntariness hearing. But I think State v. Bow makes it clear that the burden is on the prosecution. And so, yes, they raised this statement in their, they did not raise this statement in their motions in limine. But it would have been very easy for them to request a voluntariness hearing, have the voluntariness happen prior to trial, and potentially they could have gotten the statement in the correct way. So to answer, yes.
No, okay. Now let's say there was a motion for voluntariness filed. And as we know, or as at least in my experience, is oftentimes you don't have the hearing. Why? Because the defense stipulates to the voluntariness of the hearing. Is that an acceptable way to handle these voluntariness matters, presuming there's then a colloquy pursuant to Chang of the defendant?
I would see no problem with that. I think a defendant has the right to a voluntariness hearing, but they also have the right to forego that. But it should be up to the defendant. It is their constitutional right, not the state's, not the judge's. It's the defendant's right to assert it or waive it.
And what type of procedural safeguard would ensue if a defendant wants to waive the right to a voluntariness hearing?
I think, as you mentioned, a colloquy from the court ensuring that that is a intentional, knowing, and voluntary decision of the defendant, understanding the potential ramifications. I think that we have lots of situations where that type of a scenario is acceptable, where constitutional rights are at issue.
Okay, and that's sort of that process is actually laid out in the Chang case. Let's say the judge misses one small step in that Chang colloquy. Does that mean that the defendant gets a new trial?
Your Honor, I am less familiar with Chang, and so I apologize, I can't speak specifically to the requirements. But in my experience and in reviewing many cases, I have seen that a deficient colloquy can result in
a
new trial.
And that's where I'm getting at, is it seems like with, say, a Tachibana, the right to testify or not to testify, or a change of plea colloquy, is a little bit different than a colloquy that might happen with a voluntariness hearing. The main procedural safeguard for voluntariness is the hearing itself versus, you know, some sort of colloquy the defendant knows what's up.
Correct.
Don't you think there's a little bit of a difference there, that maybe if there's a minor omission of some sort of a checklist colloquy in that scenario, that it doesn't necessarily undermine the outcome of a trial?
You know, I would argue the opposite. I think that a colloquy where the colloquy itself is not the procedural safeguard, but the prior hearing is itself the safeguard, I think that the failure of the colloquy takes on more weight.
But you know, you got a defense counsel standing right next to the defendant. Doesn't the defense counsel, unless they're ineffective, have to be discussing with the defendant the consequences of testifying or not a voluntariness hearing and everything that goes in hand with that?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the axiomatic nature of constitutional rights, the fact that they, as Judge Pollack said, are our most critical procedural safeguards, we don't want to leave those to just assuming that a defense counsel does what they're required to do. And so that's why I would argue that colloquies are so important, and how it would affect something like this case, I think, as well.
Well, what specifically would you envision needing to be in that colloquy that you're speaking of?
If a defendant waives his right to a voluntariness hearing.
Correct.
I think a very similar colloquy to the Tachibana requirements. I think ensuring that the defendant has been apprised of the potential ramifications of his choice, what his constitutional rights are, what the state's evidence against him is, and what he is allowed to present as well. I think a colloquy similar to that is what would be required to ensure that any waiver of a voluntariness hearing is appropriate. And
no one, including your attorney, is forcing you to waive this right, et cetera.
True. Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know necessarily if that would be the case. I think the main idea would be that you'd want to impress upon the defendant that if that defendant has a right to testify at the voluntariness hearing, and that whatever that defendant says at the voluntariness hearing, if they decide to testify at trial, would not be used against them.
That's a great point.
Isn't that the key inquiry?
That is key. And I think that's one thing that's interesting about our case, is the defendant doesn't know the legal system the way an attorney does. And so the wheels are in motion by the time the judge is making this decision. Three officers have already testified. It's about to be the defendant's turn to testify. The judge is making these decisions. I agree with you 100%. A typical defendant would not know that, hey, I can still say something and it's not going to come back to bite me.
See, that's why I think there's a big difference between a Tachibana and this. And I don't think any colloquy that might go on doesn't necessarily have to touch the things that Tachibana talks about. They're two different and separate inquiries. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think so. Yes. My time may be up, unless there's any other...
4 minutes left.
I think rebuttal. I reserved for
reserved
rebuttal.
5 minutes.
Yes.
So yes.
Are there any other questions from the justices? I'll just close by saying the remedy in this case should be a new trial. The court cannot order the defendant or the state to hold a after-the-fact voluntariness hearing. That's from State versus White, because in effect that would be this court telling the lower court to go and make the error harmless itself. And so the remedy here should be a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vincent.
Hey, good morning. First of all, I'd like to concede that the voluntariness hearing should have been held before the trial. So there's no real issue with that. For example, as in State v. Hoffman, which you decided a couple of years ago. State would not have been able to appeal that conclusion if it hadn't been done prior to trial. So that's one good reason for doing that, among others. Second, but I think more problematic in this case is the lack of what they refer to as a chain quality, a colloquy. Okay, there was no such colloquy in this here, and I agree with Justice Edens that it doesn't have to be Tachibana. It doesn't have to be as lengthy or as thorough as Tachibana, but it does have to inform the defendant that whatever they say at the hearing is not going to be used against them at the trial. And then after that, they need to be asked, with that knowledge, do you choose to testify at your own voluntariness hearing? In this case, there's no record of that being done. Unfortunately, at the motions in limine, the defendant was on the work site, and they'd been requested to attend by Zoom. So he was not available, at least in court, although I don't see why they couldn't have taken his testimony over Zoom, possibly. Also, at trial, there was, again, Justice Ginoza noted, there was no objection at trial to the admission of the statement. We'd ask the court to make those things clear in this opinion, and we'd ask the pre-trial nature of the thing, of the first step, that it may be prospective to all cases commencing after the date of this opinion, as this court did in Chang, right? With respect to the Chang colloquy, I would also ask for prospective application in that case. I know there are some cases, there was one in the ICA.
Didn't we already rule in ITT that a voluntariness is tantamount to a motion to suppress? A voluntary hearingness is tantamount to a motion
to
suppress?
Yes, but there was...
Doesn't Chang therefore apply to a voluntariness hearing?
Well, I think that Gore, which is a longstanding law, has never been explicitly overruled. Okay, and in that case, there was no pre-trial hearing. In fact, it was cognitive.
What cases did we explicitly overrule in Chang? I can't remember.
I don't think it was explicitly overruled in Chang. So I think that
I don't believe it was. It's a 1979 case. It's still, and it said it was, that happened in the trial itself too, right?
In Gore's.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That happened at trial. They said, Gore said, "Oh yeah, you can have it during the middle of the trial. Just dismiss the jury." That's what happened in this case. Actually, the jury was dismissed in this case after the DPA asked for a ruling on the voluntariness hearing, and the hearing, a very short hearing, was conducted outside of the presence of the jury. And Fontes had testified, so we know what his side of the story was. But Tolentino was not given his; he was not instructed that he could testify without it being used against him in trial, and he was not even asked whether he wanted to testify in that case. So, we agree that's problematic, and should be done differently in the future.
Mr. Vincent, I heard you say there needs to be a voluntariness hearing pretrial. Fine. That there should have been a colloquy, there wasn't in this case. So does that add up to, in this case, that the state is conceding?
I'm arguing that it's still harmless. I think that, for example, in Hoffman, the case, there was a statement that was suppressed. It was a result of I guess they were arguing that it was a result of the officer hitting him twice, I think, right, and saying, "Don't resist," right, and this court overturned the circuit court's ruling in that case and said that it was voluntary in that case. But we think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that this statement was voluntary. Also,
what do you base that on when there's been no hearing at which Mr. Tolentino has had the opportunity to testify and tell his side of the story.
I guess he would have to, I mean, I just think it's highly unlikely that, that first of all, that he would testify.
Well, Mr. Kai.
That the officer was lying and he didn't ask him questions or.
Testimony at a voluntariness hearing would not subject that testimony to being admitted at trial. So, right, it's simply for the purpose of determining whether his statement is voluntary, number one. So I'm not sure why you say it's highly unlikely he would testify when we haven't had a colloquy in this case, by the way, informing him. But number two, Mr. Lawrence argues that what we're missing, the factual piece that we're missing in this case, is understanding how Mr. Tolentino, the effect of the physical altercation and all of that affected his, whether that his statement was voluntary at the point at which he made it.
Yeah, right. I mean.
So how do we know that? How do we just assume what you are assuming?
Yeah, I think. It's very unlikely that you're going to get a different result if you have a full-blown hearing with Tolentino testifying, and that's just that's my gut feeling. So
it seems like it's just more of a structural thing. If you don't have a voluntariness hearing for an inculpatory statement, it's a structural thing, and it really doesn't matter what the defendant may or may not have said at that hearing.
Yeah, possibly. I just think that in this case, it's highly unlikely you're going to get. I mean, in this, if you ran this case back for a retrial, I think that there's very little that's going to change.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. I asked Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Vincent. How it seems like the inculpatory statement is what triggers the voluntariness hearing. I think that's what you've conceded. But how is it determined whether a statement's inculpatory or not?
Well, I mean. I guess another thing I would concede is that, I mean, this was raised in the trial attorney's motions in limine back 6 months before trial happened. So I think everybody at that point was aware that the defense counsel objected to this as being an alleged confession, right? At that point, I think, it would have behooved the circuit court judge to hold a hearing, sua sponte, if not asked by the state.
Mr. Vincent, can you raise the microphone? Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I think what I heard from Mr. Lawrence, out of the Calicolio case, it's inculpatory if it sort of tends to establish guilt, and that should be sort of the framework. And it strikes me, I guess there's a couple categories that I can see. You could have a direct admission of guilt, I stabbed, the person. You could have maybe our situation, which I think is a relatively equivocal or ambiguous statement.
Yes.
Where does the apology really towards? Now, the prosecution used it as a consciousness of guilt, idea. Mm-hmm. So I think that puts it into the inculpatory stage. And then you actually could even have what I consider a false exculpatory statement, where the person, the defendant, just to try to exculpate themselves, makes up a story that is totally outrageous and false, and then the prosecution uses that false exculpatory statement to show consciousness of guilt, say. Mm-hmm. In any of those categories, they all suggest inculpatory use, and if that's the situation, I hear what you're basically saying. We should have voluntariness hearing on those situations.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In general, I think that there may be some gray area there, and I think that this one is, certainly.
And I suppose you would agree with Mr. Lawrence that a defendant can waive that. Two.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't think. Well, yeah, I think before they can waive that, they probably should get the Chang.
Yeah, with a colloquy and so on and so forth, as long as that's on the record.
So a statement could be inculpatory if it might go to the defendant's credibility.
I think so. Yes, I would agree with that. I have no problem with that. With Rick's statement in this case, it is ambiguous. but and it also it to some extent it favors the defendant in this case, because as was remarked, he was charged with intentionally knowing assaulting a police officer, and the jury found reckless, and it seems to me like sorry can be used to support a state of mind of recklessness. I mean, the defendant could use that to infer that there was a reckless state of mind, that I kicked out, but I didn't realize I was kicking the officer, right, or whatever, as was the allegations in this case, right? So I think that it may well have been a strategic choice in this case to just let it come in, possibly.
Well, there was a motion in limine to suppress this, to not allow the statement to come in. So,
but then at trial, there was no objection.
Under our law, if you make the motion, pretrial motion in limine, the motion is denied, the objection is preserved.
Well, I mean, this is why we do a chain.
I'm sorry?
This is why we need to have a chain quality, a colloquy. Yeah, so this is a prophylactic measure. It does away with an ineffective sense of counsel issue later on. So I think that the evidence in this case was very strong. I don't think that the statement in this case contributed to a defendant's conviction. There was,
Do you believe that in these types of situations we should be conducting a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt review for each of these statements?
Any constitutional issue can be subject to the harmless error. I think that's what the case law says. Okay, any other questions?
I have a question. The state has not filed a response, did not file a response to the cert app in this case. And I've seen that a number of times in cases that have come up involving, prosecutions and important issues. I'm just wondering why that is.
Because I don't want to just regurgitate what I wrote in my answering brief. So I always look at the my answering brief, and at that time, if I think that it sufficiently covered the issues.
Mr. Tolentino raised a number of issues at the ICA that he did not raise here. This particular question here before us is very specific to one.
I perceive them to be more or less the same issues, but maybe I didn't read it close enough.
All right.
Yeah.
Especially if the state is going to be making concessions, it would be nice to have those in the response.
Well, I didn't.
Rather than at OA.
Yeah. I understand, Your Honor. But we have numerous briefs ongoing, I look at the application for cert, and I try to ascertain whether that my answers are already contained in my opening brief. I don't want to file unnecessary briefs, but Your Honor. So I looked into it more carefully. But I do have, it's not the only brief I have.
Thank you for the concessions.
Okay, thank you.
Rebuttal.
Just briefly. To touch on what the prosecutor mentioned about whether or not the defendant actually would have testified, I think the justice, I can't remember who said it, but I think they hit it on the head that he could have testified to the effect of his treatment and what he was responding to when he made that statement. And so I think he likely would have testified at the hearing.
Well, shouldn't you have done an offer of proof then, maybe? If there's a few things defense could have done.
100%. There are a few things the defense could have done, but I think as we've discussed and as the discussion has followed, there's a duty on the court that when this issue is raised to take the appropriate steps to ensure that procedural safeguards.
Okay, I know. And I guess the only reason I bring that up is, yeah, with the defendant could have testified to this or the defendant would have testified to this. And, you know,
correct.
I mean, I'm not really persuaded by that, Mr. Lyons.
Fair. You know. Understand.
I'd like to address the relief that you've asked. Okay, so yes. In your position is that a new trial is required, yet you rely on Jackson versus Dennell, where the relief that was provided there was a voluntariness hearing, mm-hmm. and depending on what the ruling is there, a determination whether a new trial was required. What's your position as to why that part of Dennell shouldn't apply here?
Thank you. I know you
cited a particular case. I'd like to get that citation.
No problem. Thank you. I appreciate that question. The Jackson versus Dennell court was a habeas court, so they weren't the state court. And so the court, in issuing that ruling that a voluntariness hearing could be the remedy, they said, obviously, obviously the state is free to give Jackson a new trial if it so chooses. So essentially they were saying, because we're not the direct appeal court, we're not gonna tell the state court specifically what to do. They can decide. They intimated that if they had been the direct appeal court, it may have been different. So I think that's the distinguishing issue with that case.
What is the case that you cited? You cited a White case.
Yes, State versus White. This is a 1 Hawaii App 221 and a 617 P second 98. To remand for a voluntariness hearing would in effect be a directive from this court for the trial court to now make its error harmless. So essentially they're saying we're not gonna tell a court to do that.
Okay.
Speaking to the ambiguity of the statement, as I mentioned, I think ambiguity heightens the need for procedural safeguards, doesn't lessen them. I think that's precisely why a voluntariness hearing is required, is because statements like these are ambiguous, and the court needs more than just argument to be able to make a fair determination. As far as whether or not the case, whether or not this issue is harmless, I would argue that I'm not aware of any Hawaii cases. A prosecutor intimated that there are some, and if there are, I apologize, but I'm not aware of any cases that don't allow for this. But I think that a constitutional violation, by their nature, constitutional rights, when they are forfeit, I don't think that they can be harmless, because by their nature, they are constitutional within our system. They make up the system. There are two cases from outside of Hawaii that I will quote. One is People versus Harris, 269 NE 3rd 705. And there the court said that, quote, the use of a defendant's coerced confession as substantive evidence of his guilt is never harmless error, and the cause must therefore be remanded for a new trial. In Payne versus State of Arkansas, this is 356 U.S. 560, the court said, but where, as here, a coerced confession constitutes a part of the evidence before the jury and a general verdict is returned, no one can say what credit of weight and weight the jury gave the confession. And so, again, I don't think that this court can find the error harmless. And with that, I'm out of time. If there are other questions, I'm happy to answer.
There being no further questions, this court takes this matter under advisement.
Thank you so much.
Eku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki'ike hanohano oko moko aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.